Well, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here to have a kind of reunion with the Humanities Council. And especially on these issues, it's delightful to see you all here to have this conversation. I don't have a PowerPoint today. I started working on one. And this is going to confirm all of your worst cliches about humanities people. Something went wrong with the computer. There wasn't time to reconstruct it. So here we are, standing before you naked. An experience of the way things once were when we had to simply talk and you didn't have something to look at other than the speaker. I apologize for that. We'll do the best we can. In any case, it's great to be here, and it's great to be part of this forum, the Schwartz Forum on Climate Change. It was always a joy to work with Dee Dee on Humanities Council projects. She was bubbling over with creative ideas. She was on top of whatever issue the board needed to consider. She was fair-minded and judicious, and best of all, she was quick to laugh, to find the fun in the work that we shared. So I can't think of a better way to honor her memory than to hold the kind of public humanities discussion that she fostered with such skill and care. Let me begin with a comment on a recent event that was held to communicate about climate change on college campuses across the country. It was called No Tomorrow, and it was billed as an urgent plea from the millennial generation for action on climate change. The title of the initiative was a play on the words no and no, K-N-O-W and N-O. So it's important on the one hand to know in the sense of being aware of where we're headed with climate change, given the best available models of the future. But the title also suggests the ominous possibility that there will be no tomorrow. Of course, there will be a future for our biosphere, whatever we do or fail to do. But as the consequences of global climate change work themselves out, there are lots of living things, including lots of human beings, who will not be included in that future. For them, if we don't change our behavior, there will be no tomorrow. It's been estimated that as many as one-third of current species may be lost to extinction by 2050. It's not that far away, depending upon the magnitude of the shifts in global climate. That is well within the lifetime of the college students who organized the No Tomorrow demonstrations. And to many of us, it is an appalling prospect. It's true, of course, that in the history of life on Earth, species come and species go. Extinction is a commonplace in evolution. But what is unprecedented is this rate of extinction. Usually, this kind of die-off occurs only when there is some catastrophic event, like an asteroid impact. In this case, we are the catastrophe. The human losses also have the potential to be tragically large. The World Health Organization recently estimated that there are already roughly 150,000 deaths a year, human deaths a year, attributable to the effects of global climate change. Of course, tallying up deaths in such a complex set of economic and social contexts is very complex, but there's no doubt that the effects of climate change will cause much misery and many deaths over time. Furthermore, many of the people most at risk from climate change are barely able to sustain themselves already. Those who struggle just to feed themselves and their children, whether they live in the countryside or whether they're in massive urban slums, are the most vulnerable to the effects of drought and flood, of crop failures, of rising food prices, destructive storms, epidemic disease, and so on. One of the sad consequences of economic inequalities is that those who have contributed least to the problem of climate change will often suffer most from its effects. And when societies are unable to meet their citizens' basic needs, conflict and turmoil follow. So as we just heard, one important destabilizing factor in Syria was a prolonged drought and rising food prices. Given these impacts on our fellow human beings and on the whole community of life, climate change is not just an economic, political, and technical problem. It is a moral challenge. It confronts us with the question of whether we care enough about the well-being of others, both human and non-human, to make significant changes in the way we live. I don't think the jury is in on that question. For a number of reasons, global climate change presents an especially difficult set of issues for us to come to grips with. Our ordinary patterns of moral thought and action face an extraordinary challenge in communicating and confronting climate change. I want to begin by sketching several reasons for this. So I'll call these climate change traps. So the first one is a problem about timescales. When climate scientists talk about rapid change in, say, the average global temperature or in sea levels or ocean acidity or Antarctic ice sheets, they're usually referring to changes that take place over a period of 100 years or more. Some biological changes take place more quickly. I just mentioned the estimates of species loss over the next 35 or 40 years. But for human beings, that is nearly half a lifetime. The greenhouse gases we emit have effects that continue to ramify for centuries. Even if we were to stop all greenhouse gas emissions in the next 20 years, or when atmospheric concentrations of CO2 consistently reach 450 parts per million, sea levels would still be rising in the year 3000. An average global temperature would not have returned to pre-industrial levels. On geological timescales, these effects are startlingly fast. But in human time, they build gradually, insidiously, ambiguously. If global climate change turns out to be a disaster, it will have been, by human standards, by human measures, a disaster that occurs in slow motion. This makes the consequences of global climate change easy to ignore, at least for the time being. We human beings are generally not very good at responding to problems that we see as arising at some distant future time. We react most strongly to immediate challenges and opportunities. It's plausible to think that this has something to do with our evolutionary history. We've spent millennia springing into action to secure benefits here and now, another meal, and grappling with immediate threats to our survival, say the predator that might attack. I saw a report in the newspaper this week that 2,500 human beings a year are lost to crocodiles at watering holes. Okay, so you need to be quick when you're near the crocodile pond. So we are highly attuned to short-term rewards and threats and find it difficult to focus our attention on longer-term threats. Indeed, we're quite capable of ignoring long-term outcomes, even when we know they are inevitable. Consider saving for retirement, relevant for a few of us here. We know that we'll grow old, but 25-year-olds typically find it very difficult to imagine their 65-year-old self, and they're reluctant to spend less now in order to provide some income for that old geezer of the future. This has, in fact, created a looming social problem, since the experts are telling us that we baby boomers are seriously underprepared to support ourselves in retirement. This human tendency to downplay future gains and losses has come to occupy an important place in economic theory. In doing cost-benefit analysis, results are prorated for their distance from us in time. This is known as the discount rate, and it's the subject of a lot of sophisticated analysis. But the basic idea is pretty simple. It's the idea that a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. That is, a good that I presently possess is worth more to me than a potentially greater one that I might get later on. Unfortunately, when you extend this principle to environmental harms, it can have really bad effects. It becomes something like a bird in the hand now is worth more than the possible extinction of the species later. And so we make a meal of the last American passenger pigeon. Though we didn't actually eat the last passenger pigeon. It died at the Cincinnati Zoo. There was one last pair. They named them George and Martha. The last to die was Martha in 1914, September 1, 1914, last passenger pigeon. It's got in my PowerPoint, you'll have to imagine, I had a lovely picture of Martha lying dead upside down on ice. So let me give you another striking example of discounting from another context. The voters of Seaside, Washington, recently turned down a proposal to build a new K-12 school, which would have added about $220 to the tax bill on a $100,000 house. There's nothing remarkable about this. Resistance to tax increases is a commonplace, even when the money is targeted for a clear public good. What is remarkable is that the new school was proposed because three of the four current schools are located in an area that cannot be evacuated should a tsunami occur. The Cascadia subduction zone, which is where one geological plate is diving under another, is overdue for a major earthquake. Historically, there's been one such event every 243 years, and the last one was in 1700, 315 years ago. So seismologists say that there's a 1 in 3 chance that a really big one will occur in the next 50 years. And when it does, the resulting tsunami will sweep these schools away. 62% of the voters decided that this is a risk worth running, rather than adding a relatively modest amount to their property tax. Okay? That's discounting for future risk. And it seems clear that this is happening with regard to climate change, sea level rise, more powerful major storms, so on, so on. These are all the likely consequences of continuing to pump out greenhouse gases. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has carefully estimated the probability of these events under different greenhouse gas emission scenarios. But these events are not certain to occur, any particular event, and their worst effects are located off in the future someplace. And so we discount them and carry on with business as usual. Upton Sinclair famously said that, quote, "It's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it." It's easy to see the way this applies to various fossil fuel interests like the coal companies and their representatives in the U.S. Congress who denounced the so-called war on coal. But I think it's important to acknowledge that Upton Sinclair's point applies to us all, because we all live in a way that is thoroughly entangled with fossil fuel consumption. We exist in a social economic system in which we cannot avoid contributing to the problem, where we live, what we eat, how we move around, all involve pumping greenhouse gases out into the atmosphere. It's tempting for us to just keep on enjoying the benefits of our carbon-intensive lifestyle and let others later on cope with the problems that we leave behind. So what does it take to overcome our denial and move us to action? Often a timely crisis is helpful, an event that gets our attention but stops short of utter catastrophe. We seem to need an in-your-face disaster to move us to recognize and address the slow-motion disaster. But global climate change doesn't typically present us with specific events that are unambiguously attributable to the increase in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. This isn't to deny that we're already experiencing events that are typical of what we would expect in a warming world. The extended drought in the West, you just saw some slides, the unprecedented flooding in South Carolina earlier this month, the magnitude of this latest hurricane in the West, Patricia, these are all the sorts of events which become more likely in a warmer world. But global climate change is manifested in these shifting patterns, in the frequency and intensity of certain kinds of weather events, rather than in single episodes that are directly caused by increased presence of greenhouse gases. This point is often missed by both sides in the debate. A few years ago, there was a big snowstorm in Washington, D.C. Some of you may remember. And the Virginia Republican Party took great delight in sending out emails to people, urging them to call their Democratic representatives and ask them to come over and shovel out the global warming from their driveways. Now, that's really dumb. But it's also misleading to say that any particular destructive storm is caused by global climate change. Instead, we have to say that events like these are more likely as the atmosphere as a whole warms up. So it kind of seems like climate change as a natural phenomenon is almost perfectly designed to lull us into inaction, to lead us to ignore future trouble headed our way, and to persist in business as usual until it's too late to avoid the worst consequences of our conduct. In thinking about how to communicate climate change, we need to grapple with this. We need to figure out how we can counter these habits of thought that are, in fact, so dangerous to us. I want to mention a couple of considerations here that I think can be helpful. First, we already have well-established and widespread strategies for taking future risks into account. All of us in this room, I expect, own insurance of various kinds. When we buy automobile or homeowners insurance, we spend money now to insure against a future loss that may never come. We know that an auto accident or a house fire could occur, and we recognize that it's better to invest some of our resources now to provide a way of meeting the costs if this were to happen. Those who oppose adopting policies aimed at curbing greenhouse gas emissions often cite uncertainties in climate science as a reason not to act. But notice that we don't need to be certain that the loss will occur in order for it to make sense to insure against it. If the risk is substantial, the harm is substantial, and the risk is significant, then it's only prudent to insure against it. So taking steps to shift to a less carbon-intensive way of life, say by putting a price on carbon, can plausibly be promoted as a kind of upfront insurance payment in the face of the risks associated with climate change. There's another feature of insurance I think it's worth noticing. Sometimes we require people to accept the cost of insuring against risk. This is true, for example, with automobile liability insurance. The key consideration here is that other people's well-being is at stake. We've already seen that global climate change is likely to have major impacts on innocent third parties, on thousands of other species who can't adapt quickly enough to the changing climate, on the global poor of our own species, who have contributed very little to the problem, and on future human generations who will be born into a world that has been profoundly altered by our actions. Even if we ourselves do not experience the worst effects of the greenhouse gases we emit, those who come after us are likely to do so. Should we concern ourselves with the well-being of future generations? This question has triggered some really lively philosophical debate and generated articles with titles like, "What Have Future Generations Ever Done For Me?" It's one of my favorites. It's interesting to wrestle with the question of whether merely possible but presently non-existent future people can have actual rights that impose moral obligations upon us now. How can you or me, how can we be held responsible not to harm someone who doesn't even exist yet? You'll be relieved to hear I'm not going to wade into those debates. We can in discussion if you'd like. There are really interesting issues there from a philosophical, ethical, theoretical point of view. But I think it's safe to say that most of us do, in fact, believe that we have responsibilities to our children and to their children. I say this as a new and delighted grandparent. I feel I have a special stake in future generations of a very personal kind. It's a relatively small step to say that we ought to take to heart the well-being of the next generation even before the specific individuals who will be part of it have been conceived. It's also worth noting that we tend to look back with gratitude on those who came before us when their concern for the future has benefited us. Think, for example, of Percival Baxter, Governor Baxter, who gave, you know, a vast tract of land to the Maine people that has become Baxter State Park. These intuitions about cross-generational responsibilities, I think they're deeply rooted in our impulses of care for the young. And this provides a lever to work against our short-sightedness. Maybe there's the basis here for a somewhat less partisan convergence of opinion on climate change. In considering the national budget, so-called deficit hawks like to argue that it is wrong to run up a great burden of debt that you leave behind to your children to pay off. Well, the same principle can be applied to greenhouse gas emissions. We are living in ways that are running up environmental costs, a climate debt. It will have to be paid by our children and their children. Global climate change is, in effect, a huge intergenerational transfer of costs, just like financial debt. A loving and responsible, or even minimally decent, parent doesn't do that. Let me add one more sort of parenthetical remark here. I think the key to taking those questions about our descendants with full seriousness is to recognize the connection between our current way of life and the harm that we are doing even now to those who come after us. And that is a matter of honestly grappling with climate change, with climate science. The message about the hazards of global climate change runs up against the stolid and self-serving refusal to understand that Upton Sinclair described so well. It also faces active and well-funded efforts to obscure the state of scientific research and promote public confusion. For example, the New York Times recently ran yet another story on internal documents from ExxonMobil that revealed that their own scientists were warning in the 80s, that atmospheric warming had the potential to, quote, be catastrophic at least for a substantial fraction of Earth's population, end quote. In the 90s, however, the corporation decided to pour money into organizations that would publicly deny this and cast doubt on climate science. This well-funded and commercially self-interested promotion of confusion continues, and it's reminiscent, of course, of the behavior of the tobacco companies at another time. Essentially, it's a delaying tactic, but delay is dangerous for us and for those who come after us. Okay, so far I've been talking about challenges associated with the long timescales in which global climate change operates. I want to turn now to a second set of challenges. These have to do with getting human beings to cooperate with each other in addressing problems that require collective action. This is widely known as the commons problem. Over 40 years ago, ecologist Garrett Hardin wrote a now famous essay titled "The Tragedy of the Commons." The basic idea is that resources held in common are inevitably in danger of being destroyed by overuse. Consider a shared pasture, a common, that's available to all the households in the village. Perhaps as your family grows, you decide to acquire a second cow or add some sheep. If everybody does this, at some point the pasture will be pushed beyond its carrying capacity and be progressively degraded. Everyone in the village has an interest in not letting this happen. But notice, it's not in any individual's interest to refrain from adding another animal. That's because if you limit your use of the commons and others don't, then you give something up, the opportunity to have more livestock, and everyone else benefits from your admirable self-restraint. We all can agree something should be done about overuse of the commons. But everyone also thinks it would be best for someone else to go first. So each of us keeps making as much use of the pasture as we can, even though we can foresee that this eventually will make all of us worse off than we would have been had we all limited our use. This is what makes the story about the commons a tragedy. Individual rational choices in this case lead to a bad collective outcome. There are lots of examples of this in the resource systems of the planet. North Atlantic fisheries, great example. It was once said you could walk to Nova Scotia on the backs of the cod. That is no longer possible. Though with the decline of the cod, lobsters are happier. There are at least a couple ways out of this dilemma. One is to privatize the commons. Break it up into private pastures. Then if you overuse your little patch and deplete it, you are the only one who suffers the loss. This was Garrett Hardin's preferred solution. There's some obvious problems with privatization. The use of privately owned resources often has negative effects on other stakeholders. Economists call these externalities. So suppose I clear-cut my woodlot. This is going to affect water runoff, soil erosion, habitat loss, and so on, that occurs not just on my land, but on my abutting property owner's land. So that takes us right back to the commons problem. But even if there weren't difficulties of that kind with privatization, it simply isn't possible to privatize every commons. It won't work for the North Atlantic fishery. The fish, the water, the nutrients have a habit of moving around. It obviously won't work for climate change. The atmosphere of the planet is a resource we all share. It's a global commons, and it has a limited capacity to absorb greenhouse gases without widespread dangerous effects. If that's the case, then we need to address this problem through collective action. That's the second strategy of responding to commons problems. Rather than privatizing the commons, we can make an agreement with each other that limit its use. Each family gets one cow or two goats, but not all three. It's easy enough to see how that might happen, how that might work for a shared pasture. It's much more difficult to imagine it in the case of the atmosphere of planet Earth. The human species has never faced a commons problem, it seems to me, of this scope and magnitude. And it poses obvious challenges to our capacity for cooperation and rational agreement. There's a widespread and growing international consensus that anthropogenically induced climate change is a real and urgent problem that we all need to address. But just as was the case with the shared pasture, we're all quite happy to have someone else go first. The problem is compounded by the huge variability in the effects of climate change. We're not all affected in the same way and to the same degree. Some societies face existential threats, being completely inundated by rising sea levels, or being rendered uninhabitable by heat and drought. But others may find some of their prospects improving, say from an extended growing season in the far north, so that Canada becomes the breadbasket of the Americas. Maybe Siberia, similarly for Europe. So the calculations of self-interest here cut in a bewildering variety of different directions. Global climate change challenges us then to concern ourselves with collective well-being, not just with our own national self-interest. But past experience suggests that we're not especially good at that. It helps that we are already so extensively interconnected in the modern world, especially by our economic relations. You can hardly pick up the daily newspaper without seeing another story about the process of of globalization. As a student once put it in a paper for my environmental ethics class, listen carefully to this, it's well expressed, quote, "Modern communication has circumcised the earth, eliminating the problem of size." I could not have put that better. But of course, our trade relations remain competitive. Economically speaking, size matters. And the world's nation states enter climate change negotiations from very different positions. Developing countries don't want their nascent economic growth to be derailed by restrictions on fossil fuel use. They understandably look at the developed world and say, we want what you have. The industrialized nations look at the developing world and see climate disaster looming if poorer countries replicate the process of economic expansion that generated the developed world's wealth. But it's not politically or morally plausible to say, we're sorry, but you must remain poor because we, in the process of becoming rich, have used up the atmosphere's capacity to absorb carbon. The societies of the developing world are unwilling to see their economic disadvantages locked in by climate change agreements that perpetuate the advantages of the developed world. This is a really difficult problem, and it's not at all clear how it'll be resolved. It's been a central issue in climate change negotiations under the UN framework, the UN Convention on Climate Change, that was adopted in 92, and that resulted in the first agreement, the Kyoto Protocols, and then followed by a whole series of climate meetings. That process, as I'm sure those of you who followed it know, has consistently fallen short of fulfilling the high hopes that have been brought to it. But that should not surprise us, given what I've just said about the inherent difficulty of the underlying issues. The mood recently has been improved by the announcement of a joint agreement between the U.S. and China on limiting CO2 emissions. The U.S. agreed to lower our emissions by 26% to 28% below 2005 levels by 2025. And China, interesting, agreed to try to hit its peak emission sometime before 2030. They're on track to do that, in fact, with 20% of energy coming from fossil fuel by that date. By non-fossil fuel by that date. So the next big event is the Paris meeting in December this year that aims at producing a binding agreement on greenhouse gas emissions. And because international anxiety about climate change continues to build, there is a fair amount of momentum coming into those discussions. We'll want to watch them with great interest. As the international community struggles forward in this discussion of climate change, it's important to ask a moral question, a question about justice. What sort of agreement would be fair and equitable? We can frame that question in terms of costs, two kinds of costs. The costs associated with cutting back on greenhouse gas emissions and the costs incurred in adapting to climate change. So the ethical question is, what would be a fair distribution of these costs? What would climate justice look like? I'm not going to try to give you a complete answer to that question. It's a very rich and difficult question. We can talk about it more in discussion. But I want to suggest just how challenging it is for us in the developed world to honestly face this question. There are some familiar ethical principles that seem to apply here. It seems right to say, for example, that those who have contributed most to the problem and who have benefited most from doing so should bear the primary burdens in addressing it. That's a principle that looks at past behavior and assesses responsibility. We also might look ahead and formulate a principle for our actions going forward. For example, it only seems fair that everyone should be given equal consideration when deciding how much carbon we dare dump into the atmosphere. These two familiar ethical ideas have some startling implications when we apply them in practice. Consider a simple model of an equal right to carbon emissions. We could calculate each person's carbon entitlement, their fair share, by estimating the total remaining capacity of the atmosphere to absorb greenhouse gases without forcing the climate system beyond the standard target of 2 degrees centigrade, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Then we divide that number by world population and come up with a quantity of carbon or methane per person. People have, in fact, made these calculations. But we don't need to go into the details in order to see that this approach has profound implications for affluent, carbon-intensive societies like our own. China, as you may know, has now exceeded the U.S. as the top CO2 emitter. But China's emissions per capita are a lot lower than those of the U.S., approximately 6.7 metric tons per person for China versus 17 metric tons per person in the U.S. So a high population country like China or India, and India is an even more striking example, their number is about 1.5 metric tons per person. So those countries would be able to significantly increase their share of carbon output, and we would need to substantially reduce ours. I'm guessing there's virtually no chance that the U.S. public, in its current mood, where we seem to feel entitled to gasoline at $2.50 or less a gallon, would accept this as a greenhouse gas agreement. Equal per capita shares is not the only, not necessarily the best, way to try to achieve climate justice. It may be that allowing for some inequalities in carbon allowance, in fact, works to the benefit of all, including those who are least well off. Maybe every person should have a guaranteed allotment of carbon credits, part of which they could trade, selling their excess if they were efficient or frugal, and buying what they need if they were not. We'd end up with carbon-rich people. I can imagine what Donald Trump's carbon consumption would look like. We enter a realm here where theories of justice and theories of economics intersect. Both, after all, have to do with questions of distribution. Once again, you'll be relieved to hear I'm not going to wade into the details here. Again, we can do more of this in discussion if you like. But in any case, the international community is a long way from greenhouse gas emission agreements that would begin to approximate any ideal of fairness of this sort. And it's important that we bear these climate justice questions in mind as we listen to and assess what comes out of the Paris meeting. Okay, so I've talked about long time scales as a problem, the commons problem, right, and collective action as a problem. Finally, I want to mention one more problem here for us to think about. One more moral challenge. Now, that's the issue of what I call mismatch or disproportion between each of us as moral actors and the scope of the climate change problem. Simply put, the problem is global and systematic and systemic, and our actions are local and particular. The dynamics of change in the global climate system are so out of proportion to our own small lives that we can't by ourselves have an impact on it, either for better or for worse. We're all embedded in a structure of life that's carbon intensive. There's no obvious way out, as I mentioned earlier, where we live, what we eat, how we get around the world, all involve systems of production and consumption that contribute to carbon in the atmosphere. I drove down to Portland this morning in my private car, spewing out about 20 pounds of carbon. I did the calculation, I was curious. About 20 pounds of CO2. Okay? Taking a train was not an option. And if it is to be an option in the future, a whole lot has to change in our society. But transforming the nation's transportation system requires collective action beyond my own individual initiative. So suppose I drive down in a Prius. Then I cut my carbon contribution to about 12 pounds. Okay? I've driven a Prius, but I gave it to my son. I don't have any more. But that's great, that reduction in carbon emission. But that's a very, very small drop in the atmospheric bucket. My individual contribution to greenhouse gases is a vanishingly small percentage of the whole. And that means that I can't do much to solve the problem on my own. But neither can I do much to make it worse. So why bother? Why bother to worry about it, much less make personal sacrifices that I know will do little or no good? That just seems like a way of making myself miserable to no good effect, which is something that many of us tend to do, but try to do less of. I mean, after all, ruminating on problems I can't solve leads to feelings of helplessness and despair. And I think there's a lot of that in public response to global climate change. So faced with these kinds of gloomy reflections, I may decide to ignore the whole issue and just get on with my life. I think that this sense of powerlessness, this sense of being entangled in processes that we can't change, is very widespread. I also think it's entirely understandable. It's also quite dangerous. What can we say in response? First thing to say is just the obvious and simple point that we're not in this alone. If the problem is rooted in the way we live together, the way we construct our life together, so is the solution. More philosophically put, I want to suggest that we have moral responsibilities not only for how we act as individuals, but also for how we act as a group. That is, as an individual, I have duties to act with others collectively in certain ways. Obviously, I can't discharge that duty alone. I need to be part of a community of cooperation. And where such a community is missing, I need to do what I can to form one. This is, in fact, a familiar idea to us. It's often said that citizens have a duty to vote, a duty to exercise this power you possess as part of a political community. Of course, a lot of people don't vote. And if they're ever challenged to say why not, they make exactly the same kind of arguments I just sketched regarding climate change. Okay? My vote is just one among millions and makes a vanishingly small contribution to the outcome of the election. If I thought it would make a difference, I'd vote, but it won't, so I don't. Right? Most of you have probably heard that argument. But that doesn't justify not voting. The whole point of voting is that the results are additive. And taken together, our choices have a profound effect on our life together. So we can make a similar point about actions taken at the individual level to reduce carbon emissions. Our individual choices don't make much difference, but added together, they have significant effects. When we make choices about how to spend money, we are in effect casting our economic votes. And the marketplace is eager to give us what we want if money can be made. By purchasing fuel-efficient cars, we help create a market for them, with the result that car companies will make more of them. Unfortunately, the American public is going in the opposite direction at the moment. With gas prices down, it turns out sales of hybrid and electric vehicles have gone flat. In fact, they've started to decline. Sales of SUVs are up. There's a challenge to be addressed there. But if there are enough consumers who care about climate change, we can reshape the market through our choices. Now, I want to quickly add that I'm not saying that the world's climate system should simply be left to the tender mercies of consumer preferences in the marketplace. It seems clear that market dynamics alone won't get us where we need to go. Each of us has interests not only as consumers, but also as citizens. And as citizens, we're called to concern ourselves with more than just our own private good, with what I want to consume for my own satisfaction. We're called to concern ourselves with the public good. Maybe a better way to put it is to say that the good for me includes living in a good society, a society that seeks to embody certain values in its way of life. This common good, I would argue, may lead me to act as a citizen against some of my own desires as a consumer. Going back to the automobile example, suppose I like the idea of driving a really big, heavy vehicle. I had a conversation with a colleague just the other day who said he'd sold his motorcycle, but he'd bought a big pickup truck, and so he felt he was still a real man. You've seen the ads for the large pickup trucks. You have hardworking men, you have tools and equipment, you have dirt and mud. I mean, it's conceivable that some, you know, effete college professor like me might think that, yes, I need one of those. Right? It's not, in fact, my view. I may nonetheless advocate for policies like higher CAFE standards, corporate average fuel economy standards, that diminish the availability of such vehicles. The public good is not determined just by adding up everyone's individual consumer preferences. We may choose, as a matter of public policy, to impose some constraints on our ability to get what we want. Our free markets are, in fact, routinely shaped by all sorts of forces, including a variety of policies adopted out of a concern for public good. In the 50s and 60s, the U.S. chose, as a society, to pour money into an interstate highway system rather than into a system of public transportation. We can now choose to incentivize alternatives to internal combustion engines powering vehicles carrying most often one individual at a time. One promising policy of this kind would be to put a price on carbon that more truly reflects the costs associated with pumping it into the atmosphere. Carbon tax, for example, could be structured in a way that's revenue neutral. So the extra money you spend on gas would be made up in savings elsewhere, say in a payroll tax. And that could be used to stabilize petroleum prices at levels high enough to create economic incentives for efficient use of fossil fuels and the development of non-fossil fuel alternatives. Maybe a cap and trade system would be better. Leave it to the economists to figure that out. The point here is just that we can use public policy to reshape economic incentives and to make systemic change. And this can be done through democratic procedures that empower us to accomplish together what we cannot accomplish alone as individuals. I want to conclude with a few remarks on the role of religion in public life. I teach in both a philosophy department and a religious studies department, and so these two sides of me both need to find a voice. So a few concluding remarks related to these comments on public life. You're probably aware that Pope Francis recently released a papal statement, an encyclical letter on the environment titled Laudato Si, Praise to You. It's from the first line of a canticle by St. Francis of Assisi, thanking God for, quote, our sister, Mother Earth. The letter has attracted a lot of press attention, fair amount of anxious discontent in some circles, because in it, Francis acknowledges and accepts the consensus among scientists about the anthropogenic origins of global warming. And he goes on to make an eloquent appeal for action to address the root causes of the problem. In his view, these root causes have to do with how we conceive of ourselves and our place in the world, and with what we value. We treat the natural world, he says, as a resource to be plundered in order to satisfy our apparently limitless appetites. He doesn't hesitate to criticize preoccupation with the accumulation of personal wealth and the display of that wealth in self-advertising, self-aggrandizing acts of conspicuous consumption. He's even had the temerity to challenge what might be called our secular faith in capitalism, our trust that the boundless pursuit of private profit will promote the good of all. He repeatedly emphasizes the link between the exploitation of the natural world and disregard for the plight of the tens of millions of human beings relegated to the margins of the world economy. And he calls us to a renewed regard for the natural world, not just as a resource to be ransacked, but as, quote, our common home, end quote, which calls for our care and even love. All this is grounded for Francis and the faith he represents in an understanding of the world as God's good creation, which has value independent of our interests and which shines with a goodness which we are called to acknowledge, respect, and enjoy. Francis's encyclical is all the more important because not all Christians, past or present, have drawn these same conclusions from their founding texts and traditions. Lynn White, some of you may be aware of a famous essay by Lynn White, wrote in the early 70s, arguing that the Judeo-Christian stories of creation in Genesis give rise to a relentlessly anthropocentric view of the natural world. White contended that these stories fostered the idea that the non-human world was given to us for our use and is significant only as a backdrop for the drama of human history, which is all about the outworking of sin and salvation and which points us beyond this world to the next. It's not hard to find examples of that kind of thinking. Some of you may be, like me, old enough to remember James Watt, who was Ronald Reagan's Secretary of the Interior. Watt was an evangelical Protestant, and he notoriously explained at a prayer breakfast that there's no need to preserve natural resources and environments because their only purpose is to meet our needs. They were given to us by God. And in any case, Christ will soon come again and the earth will be no more. I wish I could say that none of our current crop of pious politicians hold similar views. In fairness, it's important to note that for a number of years, there's been a growing and now thriving evangelical environmental movement. Richard Cizik played a key role in all that. In any case, the Pope's encyclical emphatically disassociates the Catholic Church from this way of interpreting the faith. Lynn White suggested that if religion is a crucial source of our environmental crisis, it also has a vital role to play in its solution. Religious conceptions of the world and our place in it can provide the kind of deep value orientation that's needed to address the problem. And White proposes that religious thinkers cultivate these themes within their tradition. So he mentions Francis of Assisi as someone who could be held up as an environmental saint. So it's fitting that the Pope who has adopted, the first Pope ever to adopt the name Francis, should take such a clear and public stand on climate change. Francis's statement on the environment has had a remarkably widespread impact. But you don't have to be a Catholic Christian to recognize the timeliness of challenging our culture of frenetic consumption and the wisdom of calling us to more enduring and durable values. Coming from a very different religious tradition, the Dalai Lama has made similar, remarkably similar statements. Rather than invoking a theology of God's care for creation, he calls upon the Tibetan Buddhist doctrine of universal compassion for all beings suffering in the cycle of rebirth. And he too has been widely influential. So there's a convergence here, suggesting that the deepest sources of our environmental crisis are moral and spiritual. The problem at root has to do with what we value, with the deep attachments that drive the way we live. The Pope and the Dalai Lama and any number of others invite us to reflect more deeply on the sources of meaning and satisfaction in our lives. They encourage us to cultivate richer forms of connection to each other and to the natural world. This is not so much a matter of telling us that we shouldn't have what we want. It's more a matter of urging us to want differently, to liberate our desires from relentless domination by the commercial culture in which we find ourselves. This is both a turning away from an increasingly destructive way of living and a turning toward renewable sources of deep happiness. Of course, human beings have always grappled with these questions, but now the questions have a special urgency because we're able to see that our choices have global consequences. This is a striking connection between the micro and the macro, between perennial questions of how I ought to live and the surprising new recognition that together we're forcing the planetary climate system into an unprecedented new state. Global climate change underscores the subtle ways our lives are linked to each other and to the lives of other creatures. And it challenges us, challenges each of us to undertake the transition that is needed for the well-being of all. One way of sustaining hope that we can change the world is by beginning the change in ourselves. If enough of us change the way we live, then we do, in fact, change the world. And as the world changes, it becomes easier to change ourselves. So then we have a virtuous rather than a vicious cycle. Thank you.
Tom, thank you so much. We want to stay on schedule, but let's just take time for one or maybe two questions. I actually had a question about the detail of your passenger pigeon slide.
Yeah.
But I'm going to save that for the panel discussion. Maybe just one or two.
Thank you. Hi, Hillary Webb. I enjoyed what you said very much, or I don't know if enjoyed is the word. Let me just say it hit home. I am the no longer so proud owner of a Volkswagen diesel car. You know, and of course I bought that car and happily spent a little extra money since I could afford it to do what I felt was something good. And knowing how difficult it is to find those things, you know, that I can really latch on to say, okay, this is not, maybe not part of the solution, but I'm less of a problem than I might have been some other way. So now as I'm driving around in my toxic car, I start to think about, what do I do? Do I take a sledgehammer to it and bury it in my backyard? Do I keep driving it to see what solution they come up with? And that may be 2 years down the road. Do I sell my car, take a loss, and potentially sell it to somebody who is going to drive it more than I will? And so now my cute little car that I used to jump into and you know, roll around town, I find a source of sadness and stress and hopelessness. And, you know, thinking about what do we, you know, what can we do? I have to say, I don't know who to trust any longer, because these people who were putting out a car that I thought was, you know, if not part of the solution, then at least semi-neutral or a less than problem, I certainly find myself feeling frustration and helplessness. And so the 3 points that you brought up roll into my dilemma significantly. So you articulated them very well. Thank you.
Just a word of encouragement about your VW. It's a complicated story. I mean, the VW, they're cheating. The result is these diesel engines are putting out more nitrous oxide than they're supposed to. On the other hand, their gas mileage is darn good. So there's a trade-off there.
Tom, thank you.
Yep.
All right.